Welcome along to another live episode of Glow West, where we discuss sex, sexuality and the body. Glow West is delighted to be a part of the Tortoise Shack Network. And if you like the content, please rate and review as it does help other people find it. For my lovely audience here today, you can send in questions using the chat function and then there will be time at the end to ask questions yourselves if you're brave enough to do so. So today I'm chatting with Boulani Mafako, who's originally from South Africa, and he entered the asylum process in Ireland in 2017 after leaving his native South Africa. He's an activist with MASI, which are the Movement of Asylum Seekers in Ireland. So thanks a mil for coming on and finding good Wi-Fi down in Limerick. Appreciate that. How are you today?
I'm very good, thanks. And thank you for having me, Caroline.
No, thank you so much for coming on. And I know it's a busy time given everything that's happening in Ireland at the moment and all the work that MASI's doing. So we definitely appreciate it. Do we start at the start? I suppose, do you want to tell us a little bit about your story and how you ended up coming to Ireland?
I would have come to Ireland before 2017, but I would have claimed asylum in November 2017. Before that, I had traveled from Cape Town in February of 2017. And when I was back home, I learned of the murder of one young lesbian woman who lived down the road from where I lived. She was there were only three of us who were openly gay. She was the only woman who was openly gay there, and the other one was an openly gay man, and I would have been the third one. She was abducted from her house, and she was brutally murdered. She was shot dead in an open field for no reason other than her sexual orientation. Jeez. And before that, yeah, there would have been quite a lot of violent incidences involving LGBT plus people who are either stoned to death, burnt to death, or sexually assaulted. There is a phenomenon called corrective rape, where they target lesbian women and rape them for the purpose of showing them what they are supposedly missing out. It's horrific when it happens to people, and the idea that it could happen to you or that you could be next frightened me. I would have been in the Khayelitsha Health Forum, and in the Khayelitsha neighborhood watch, there is a network of neighborhood watches, would have been working with the police to stamp out violence in Khayelitsha. But there comes a point where you actually just want to live your life and not live in fear every time when you step outside your house and not knowing that you'll come back alive.
That's not living.
So I got tired of surviving and I wanted to live and left South Africa and claimed asylum in Ireland.
Oh. But I read an interview before where you said the laws in South Africa were really good around, you know, protecting gay people, but that's not what happened in reality.
Yeah, well, in Ireland, you had a referendum for your marriage equality, but we never had referendums in South Africa. They're not constitutionally mandated. And so that means that for activists campaigning for anything on fundamental human rights, you would have to convince the 490 members of the South African National Legislature, so 90 in the upper house and 400 in parliament. So it's easier in that sense that you're only focusing on your lobbying parliamentarians. The other route, of course, is through the courts, and that's how it happened in South Africa. LGBT rights were won in the courts. So the right to adopt children, for instance, the right to donate blood, the right to enter into marriage was all won through the courts. We would have had protests and all that, but you didn't get much public support for something like that. You would only get it in the courts. The courts became the key area. In fact, for any area in South African public policy discourse that is seen to be contentious, you are most likely to achieve victory in the courts. So whether it be housing, whether it would be migrant rights, for instance, or any other area of law that requires change but is too contentious for politicians, the best route is to go to court. And that's what happened in South Africa. So the law changed swiftly, very quickly. In fact, I was emotional when I was writing an essay in UCD on gender. And I was looking at how the law has transformed when it comes to women's rights, just women's rights. And you just saw the change over time from 1996 when South Africa adopted the constitution and the post-apartheid constitution. And you saw a huge transformation, a wave of transformation in law. But in reality is that society hasn't changed that much. So social opinion still prevails. So you'd get same violence when it comes to women, for instance. You'd get women being murdered, raped, and all that. Like sexual incidences of domestic violence, for instance, are very high. Gender-based violence is extremely high. Same thing with migrants from other African countries. You get a lot of xenophobic violence, people being attacked from their homes. And so all of that means nothing if the law is divorced, all those legal protections are divorced from the lived experience of the people they are meant to protect. And so we've seen quite a lot of progressive laws in South Africa. On the books, you can tick all the boxes, but when it comes to reality, it's very, very much different experience for all the different vulnerable groups in the country.
And then you mentioned as well before that, you know, you weren't living in South Africa, you were surviving and looking over your shoulder. But then when you moved to direct provision, you almost had the same experience because you're cooped up with people who are homophobic as well. So you're still having to look over your shoulder all the time as well. So you've got the same kind of parallels going on.
Yeah, it is quite horrendous because, I mean, you can imagine life as an asylum seeker in Ireland would be very different to your life when you're living in your household, because in your household, you are able to control who comes in. Like, if you don't want a guest in, you show them the door, get out. Like, I don't have that luxury when I live in Nokishin Direct Provision Center. I couldn't tell the lad who was I was sharing a room with to get out of the room. Like, we were all going to sleep together in one room. He told me that he doesn't like gay people. Like that, he says, I don't like that shit. When he found out that I'm gay, that boys are supposed to be with girls. Or like, actually, that's not how life works. And you're in Ireland of all countries. You're the prime minister of this country is an openly gay man. Like, did you get that bit? So our life experiences are very different to the life experiences of Irish people. It would be the same for LGBT plus people in the asylum system. We find quite a lot of gay people in drag provision who actually end up being in the closet, not just because they want to be in the closet, but because the environment that they live in is such that they couldn't live a free life if they were out. They were openly out. My ex-boyfriend, for example, lived in a direct provision center, a different one that I'm in, but he wasn't out, so it meant that we couldn't actually even ask for a transfer to be together. We couldn't meet and just have any intimacy besides waiting for my roommate to be out. So if my roommate is out for a few days, then that means I could have somebody over. Otherwise, there is no sex life. There is no relationship outside in that environment.
Yeah, and that's something that's in homeless services as well. You know, I used to work with women in homeless services, and they would sneak out and they're having sex in fields and in tents because they actually bushes, don't have anywhere private. Yeah, and like that's not, there's not a lot of dignity around that, that like intimacy is a human right, really, you know, and if you're having to wait for roommates to sneak out, there's not a whole lot of dignity in that either.
It deprives a person of liberty. Like, if you can think of a dog, you feed a dog, you give it food and you give it shelter, but that's not all that a dog needs. It needs more to have life. Like, you need to take the dog out for a walk. That's a social experience for a dog to be going around, jumping around and playing around. You don't have that in a direct provision center. We don't have much of social life on 3880. So when you are put in a direct provision center with given 3880, you're expected to wait there for about 9 months before you are entitled to work. It means that you've been stripped of all the things that make life worth living. Like very basic things like smelling your own cooking. Like, for instance, I don't even remember the last time I cooked something that I actually enjoyed. You just go through the motions of eating whatever is provided there, doing whatever it is that you can in that moment. That's not living, because you are merely surviving. You eat just so that you don't starve to death, not that you are actually enjoying what you are eating. That would be the same for other aspects of life, such as sexual relations, for instance. There is no way of having a sexual life, even if you are married, if you are stuck in a hotel bedroom with all three of your children and your partner. There's no privacy there. Like.
No. And is it even the case the same with, you know, access to sexual health services as well? You know, maybe perhaps if you're having sex in such negative environments and you know, situations, open conversations about access to sexual health and contraception, how does that work in direct provision?
We had we recently had an organization in Cork send condoms and looped to direct provision centers, and some of people were surprised to see them run out very quickly. It's like, so there's a demand for it's like,
put to good use.
Yeah, we are human beings, like we have the same needs. So it's very difficult in some remote, you can imagine that it's difficult for rural Ireland in general to have access to sexual health services. So I'm based in Knocklesheen. The nearest sexual health clinic is the one next in the regional hospital. That's where I go for my PrEP. But to get there, I need to get a taxi in order to get there. The first time I needed to go to that regional hospital, I had to argue with the welfare officer because she didn't want to book a taxi for me to go to the hospital. I was like, actually, I need to go to the hospital. I'm not going to grow wings and fly to the hospital. You know, we live in the middle of nowhere with no public transportation. How do you expect me to go from here to the hospital? I have an appointment with the doctor. I need to see a doctor. So arrange for me to get there. That's your job, like. And having that, to even have to argue for something that very basic, is degrading for a person, because you have to, every time you interact with a welfare state, anywhere in the world, you literally have to degrade yourself and remind yourself of how poor you are, to prove that you need the support. And we got to the regional hospital, and when they are booked, I'm able to go through that. But the idea is that people should have access to services without going through that length of bureaucracy or having to even argue with bureaucrats in order to have access to the service. So if you're in a direct provision center that's in rural Ireland, it's likely that you won't know all the services that are available to you, particularly when it comes to sexual health and contraceptives. A lot of people didn't know that we could get PrEP, for instance, in the STI clinic for free. So only when people have that information. We do have outreach groups that go into direct provision centers, but those outreach groups only go in for maybe once in a while. And when they do go in, the posters are almost always in a negative light because they are always there to raise awareness about HIV. It's great that we want to talk about HIV, but HIV is not all there is to sex. Mm-hmm. There are other aspects of sex, like procreation. People want to have children. People want to discuss those things as well, and so, and pleasure for that comes with sex. And so when you put in something on a poster to say, we want to, only people who are interested in finding out about HIV will go there. And we know from experience, I come from South Africa with a high prevalence of HIV. We know from experience that actually it doesn't attract a lot of people. But when we put out condoms and lube on the desk, we just put them there in the reception area. They disappeared very quickly. So people want to engage. It's just a matter of outreach groups understanding what kind of language they need to be using in order to reach out to communities.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been a long, ongoing problem in Ireland for, you know, decades, centuries. But yeah, obviously blind
even
spots.
With access to medication, like we had people who had trouble accessing HIV treatment, for example. So you can imagine if you were diagnosed in your country, and you end up in Ireland and you have to wait for a PPS card and you need an appointment for a PPS card. Sometimes they run into a month in Dublin, if you're in the Dublin area, to get a PPS card in order for you to apply for a medical card. And then you can go for it. You run out of your HIV medication. Yeah. What happens in that instance? And so there is quite a lot of need for supports, for sexual health supports to be reformed in Ireland in general, and particularly for vulnerable groups such as asylum seekers who live in direct provision centres that are in the middle of nowhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. And like, you know, you said, yeah, there about like how dehumanising it all is, and it absolutely is. But I think something that you said as well really shocked me before, that you're now a certified homosexual because you have to prove to the Department of Justice and Equality that you are legitimately gay. And so you're actually certified now. Like, talk us through that process, because you're trying to explain that to people. Like,
it's
it just
horrendous.
Sounds nuts.
It's horrendous. Like, if you remember in apartheid South Africa, before they introduced apartheid, one of the logics of apartheid was that you would classify people and grant them privileges based on their race. You needed to then classify it in some sort of official documentation. So you had a lot of people going through what they called the pencil test. If they put a pencil on your hair and it sticks on your hair, you are not white.
Okay.
And therefore, you won't be granted. If it falls and your skin is light enough, you're probably white. And so you ended up with a lot of people being declared white when they actually, they went. But they could, that meant for families, for instance, that they couldn't be together in public. So if they were together in public, the parents would have to pretend that the child, for instance, is a child. And I think Trevor Noah does quite a lot of work on that. My lecturer in UWC was in the same position. He was declared white, but he came from a heritage of mixed, not mixed, but what do we call it? Imported slaves. So he was a descendant of imported slaves. South Africa imported quite a lot of slaves from other parts of the world, such as Malaysia, into South Africa. But because his skin was light, and his hair was straight enough, he passed as a white person in apartheid South Africa. It's the same when it comes to policing sexuality, for instance, in the asylum process in Ireland. They would use very stereotypical things, not just in Ireland, by the way, in other countries it happens. In the island next door in the UK, it happens. They would use stereotypical questions that police our sexual orientation. So do you look gay? How does a person look gay? So they have some idea of what a gay person looks like. They didn't ask me quite a lot because they also got a court order to look through a person's social media accounts. If an asylum seeker claims asylum, they can look. And in fact, the person who I think was an actually gay person that they got the court order for. And so they could look through social media accounts. I would assume, because they didn't give me much hassle, I would assume that they would have looked at my social media accounts, something
like
that.
Are you meant to be posting like gay porn or something? I love men over and over again?
Maybe you need to say I love men. Oh, I'm hanging out in the George or something like that. Because there was somebody who was rejected because they didn't know where the George was. Like if you took me from Dublin and transferred me to Knocklashane in the middle of nowhere in Clare. What the hell am I going to do in the George with 2160 back then? We were getting 2160 per week. What are you going to do in the George? So how are you even going to know that there is a bar called the George? You might know it online, but what are you going to do there on 2160? How are you getting there? So they used the typical questions. The first question they asked me was, when did you realize that you're gay? I don't remember a time when I thought I was straight. And then they moved on to other questions. And then they came back to the same questions, rephrased this, when did you realize you are different? I don't think of myself as different. Different from what?
Yeah. I'd say they didn't know what to say to that.
No. The person who was interviewing me was gay himself because I had seen him on Grindr. So.
that's your proof, right? You should be like, here's your account.
Maybe I should have sent him back his nudes.
With a thumbs up or something.
Yeah. But for a lot of people, it's difficult to even engage in that conversation, particularly for people who come from Zimbabwe. My ex-boyfriend is from Iran. There was no way he could have lived as an openly gay person in Iran. Mm-hmm. So even the idea of gay, it's only known as a slur in some countries. So they would not have a word for homosexuality except for derogatory terms. And so when we use very binary stupid conceptualization of what human sexuality is, it does actually cause harm to people who come to this country seeking protection from persecution. Like my ex couldn't live as an openly gay person in Iran. There's no way he was going to live as an openly gay person here because he would have been shunned by his community, his Iranian, the diaspora community. Like he didn't want anybody knowing that he was gay, but whenever he came to Knocklashane to see me, he didn't care who was around to see because he didn't know anybody in Knocklashane. And so in that sense, he could just to be himself, but in other settings, there's absolutely no way that he could live. And so it's the same for people in Zimbabwe, people who come from Uganda. There's no way of living as an openly gay person. There was somebody from Zimbabwe who was whose application was rejected because he didn't belong to an LGBT support group in Zimbabwe. Like, if you join one in Zimbabwe, in a country where it's criminalized, you're actually putting a target on your back.
Absolutely. Unless
the only way we used to do it in South Africa when even there's no criminalization of homosexuality in South Africa, but people found it difficult to belong to those, to participate in those group activities because it puts a target on your back. You're not going to be in that group setting. We can march together at Cape Town Pride, but you're not going to be in that Pride parade forever. You're going to go home. When the sun goes down, you're going home after Pride. When the confetti settles, you go home and you're on your own there. You're not going to be going in that group setting. And so, vulnerable to harm. And it has happened to people where they simply, because they went out, somebody was stabbed after an argument in a bar. They just argued in a bar over sexuality and they were stabbed to death.
Okay.
Just a simple debate of sexual orientation. So in that instance, you don't... You're not going to come out in that. And then you come to an island where a bureaucrat expects you to conform to a very narrow set. Like, even Irish gay people wouldn't meet the criteria that they set for LGBT plus people to prove that to prove their sexual orientation.
It's so bizarre. Like, you know, like being gay or being any way on the spectrum of LGBT plus, it takes so many different forms and languages evolving so much on such a constant basis. So you can imagine some stuffy, official in the department not being as up to date on, you know, what asexuality is or demisexuality or what it's like to be a trans person. Jesus. Yeah.
They made a comment on one bisexual woman. They said she did not show feelings of shame that would ordinarily be associated with somebody who was bisexual. I was like, what? So you can't be bisexual and proud now?
What? I wouldn't pass that test. I'm bisexual. I don't have any shame. So I wouldn't pass that test. Jesus.
But they expect that. So it's very messy.
Yeah.
And it affects quite a lot of people's lives because it may well mean that the person would be deported from an island to a country where they might face serious harm. The United Kingdom recently was ordered to bring back somebody they deported, I think about 5 or 6 years ago. And they were ordered to bring that person back to the UK to reassess their application. So I'm working currently on a project, but not on sexual orientation, but on survivors of sexual violence. We've seen quite a lot of women survivors of sexual violence, having their applications rejected in the first instance because they are not believed by the bureaucrats in the International Protection Office in the Department of Justice, where they tell them that the applicant is not deemed credible. They do the same, by the way, on sexual orientation. So they might say the person's sexuality or the claim that the person is bisexual is not deemed credible.
Wow.
They do the same with survivors of sexual violence. We've had quite a lot of women who have had to go through a lengthy appeals process in order to get any form of protection in Ireland because they were not believed in the first instance. I'm currently working on a project. I don't know when I'm going to publish it, but very busy
we'll share that. It's shocking because sexual violence is just treated so badly in Ireland anyway, and the lack of cases that go to court as well. I know the Irish Refugee Council, they identified like three of the main issues for LGBT asylum seekers. So one we've already touched on, the idea of being a credible homosexual, which is ridiculous. And then lack of early identification of the special needs. So you said like getting medical supports and counselling service. And then the last one was the experience of bullying and sexual harassment towards LGBT people living in direct provision. Do you think there's any more? Because three seems kind of small, considering like the realities of the situation.
There is quite a lot because there isn't much of a social life for, you can imagine trans people, for instance. When we speak about LGBT plus people, we never really focus on specific groups within the LGBT plus community. We always assume to be a community. But our issues, my issues as a gay man are very different issues for a transgender asylum seeker, for instance. I don't need surgery. I don't need hormonal treatment. I don't need any of that. And so for trans people, it's very, you can imagine the same trans issues for trans people in Ireland. Irish people would be the same for asylum seekers, except for that asylum seekers might be unemployed, so they might not even be in a position where they could ever get surgery, for example. They may never be in a position where they would ever afford surgery. And so quite a lot of trans people, even in the Irish community and amongst migrant community, tend to end up in sex work, not because sex work is their job, their dream job, But because they want to be able to make ends meet, they might end up in sex works for housing. If they got to pay rent, they might end up doing that because no other avenue will provide them with the care because of the discrimination as well, particularly when you are a male to female transgender person. It becomes very difficult for people to, I mean, dysphoria is something that a lot of people who aren't trans don't understand. And we've seen that through the bureaucracy where they just dismiss it. It was like, you can join a support group there. There is TENI. You can go to TENI meetings and that's it. But it doesn't actually address the core issues with the person has. It doesn't address any of the access problems, access to healthcare that a person has. So having a support group is great that you have a network of people you can have a chat with when you need a chat. But a chat doesn't solve all the problems that people encounter. It's the same for asylum seekers. And so when we talk about LGBT plus people, the issues are very, very broad, depending on which person you speak to in the direct provision center. So somebody might have their own room, for instance, in a direct provision center. That doesn't mean that they're not going to experience bullying because they are still in a direct provision center in a congregated setting with other people from different parts of the world who actually are very conservative. So we come from very conservative. Most asylum seekers come from conservative societies. And so we don't leave our bigotry at the port of entry. We travel with that bigotry. I probably have my own bigotries, but I didn't drop that at the port of entry when I entered Dublin. And that would be the same for the asylum seeking community. When you put them in a direct provision center, then you're confining them to that. And that becomes an everyday life experience. And so that bullying becomes an everyday life experience. It becomes something else. Psychological problems come from that because you get depressed of having to deal with homophobic slurs and bullying on a day-to-day basis. There's a huge impact on a person's mental health. And you know, mental health supports in Ireland are pathetic. The only thing they give you is sleeping pills or antidepressants, which also does not address the problem, but merely compounds it.
Oh, absolutely. And then the dehumanization of interacting with services that, you know from your friends' experiences, they're not going to believe you from the outset. No. And, you know, we heard about the case of Sylvia as well, the trans woman, who was a trans woman, but placed in men's accommodation and then buried by the state without ceremony and without notifying any of her friends of the burial. So, that's just shocking, the cruelty and the dehumanization of that experience as well. And I suppose when you hear stories like that, it just it's shocking and depressing.
The problem with the state, it doesn't think of asylum seekers as people, as human beings with needs. So their needs list is very short. They bed and 3 meals a day. Marcy had a meeting with the Department of Justice on the 29th of August last year. And in that meeting, I was very frustrated. I don't know how I didn't flip the table because on the one side of the table, we were talking about rights. And on the other side of the table, it's people concerned about beds and numbers, number of beds available. It doesn't matter where the bed is, even if there's 7 beds in one tiny bedroom, as long as you have a bed, that's all they think about. And that is very frustrating because it tells us that they don't really care about the lives that we actually have to live. They don't think about the everyday experiences of life. They strip meaning away from life. The minute you are not allowed to do all the things that human beings do, that's life's gone. You literally watch people live their lives and go on about their day-to-day lives. We watch Irish people go on about their day-to-day lives and we are reminded that actually we can't do many of the things that Irish people get to do. We will only be able to do those things if they give us a decision that's positive, that says we can stay in Ireland, only then we can start to rebuild. And it's very, very hard when you've been out of the labor market for a long time, when your education qualifications, it's difficult to even have those qualifications recognized, particularly in professions that require registration because it costs money to register as a nurse, for instance, or as a pharmacist. Now, if it costs almost 2,000 to register as 2,000 euro to register as a pharmacist, you're an asylum seeker. You were not allowed to work for 9 months.
You're
not going to have that. So people will end up being stagnant. So they end up working in low-paid jobs, and a lot of them actually get stuck in those jobs. They never really progress to their actual profession because those jobs only pay them to get by. They don't pay them to be able to save up enough to actually go on with their professional qualifications. So we got a lot of underemployment in the migrant community. The Economic and Social Research Institute recently published actually a very good report confirming just that, that a lot of migrants in Ireland are underemployed, and that would be the same for asylum seekers in direct poverty.
Absolutely. When you mentioned that was an old meeting, but that might as well have been Leo's speech the other day, which basically said, well, we give you food and a bed. So what are you complaining about?
And pocket money.
Pocket money. Like,
like your child. Like,
yeah, like there you go. Like, there's your pat on the head and take your money. Yeah. And it really just showed that absolute lack of caring. And I did the email thing, you know, that when Massey sent out the template and said, email your TDs. Yeah. And I got one back from my TDs, Pascal Donahue. And it was basically word for word Leo's thing of like, well, we give them food and shelter.
It's the same from them. Yeah. There is a great denial in amongst the political class in Ireland on rights of asylum seekers when in direct provision. A lot of them don't want to even think about direct provision as a problem. So for them, it's all okay. It's grand as long as you have a roof over your head and you have 3 meals in a day. And then you get your pocket money of 38.80. You should be grateful for that. Everything else that children are trapped in poverty, like women having to sell sexual favors in order to make ends meet, that's all ignored. Like, it doesn't matter to them. You're expected to show gratitude for the little that you are given. But actually, there are quite a number of reports that have been published on direct provision. The Special Rapporteur on Child Protection published a report recently calling for Ireland to abolish direct provision. The Faculty of Pediatricians published a report calling for direct provision to be ended. The UN Special Rapporteur, the UN's Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination published a report on the same, calling for direct provision to be phased out and for people to be assisted to live independently in the community. So there's quite a lot of work that has been done to document the horrific experiences that people go through in direct provision system. But there is quite a lot of ignorance when it comes to the political class in Ireland in addressing those issues. So they're unwilling to address them. It will take quite an awful lot on the part of activists to get them to a position where they admit that actually here we've stripped people of the right to privacy, we've stripped them of the fundamental human right to dignity, and in EU law, the right to dignity is inviolable. But here it seems to be all, you know, you can do as you please with asylum seekers, nobody cares.
Do you think the recent protests for Black Lives Matter will hopefully speed up that process of like forcing politicians to care? Because obviously they were started with the events in America, but we said, well, hang on, like we have a lot of racism in Ireland. It's not just solidarity with America. It's like, let's actually look at the racism here for migrants and travellers and ethnic groups in Ireland. So do you think that that will actually speed up that process?
It has forced us to have that uncomfortable conversation about change in the asylum system, but it has not materialized in terms of changes. We haven't actually seen politicians making their decisions to actually change the system for asylum seekers. So for us as campaigners, we are hoping that the discourse will move from saying you get a bed and 3 meals a day, and you get your pocket money, to actually we will abolish the system of direct provision and replace it with a more humane asylum system, because quite a lot has been done on documenting the experiences of children in direct provision who have to live in poverty, who grow up in poverty. Their life experiences are very different to the life experiences of Irish children who go to the same schools, by the way. A child who lives in a direct provision center will be picked up by a bus. The bus will take them to a direct provision center, and that's it. Their social experience ends there. Unless the parent has managed to fork out all the money that is required for extracurricular activities, then they can go. But some of them would go to school carrying the same sandwich every single day of their life. Like, it's the same sandwich, it's the same small yogurt. You don't get that normal childhood, especially when you're sharing your bedroom with all your siblings and your parents as well. There isn't that much privacy. Imagine as a teenager, all your teen years would be wasted all the way in direct provision centers. And we've had quite a lot of children. So for Leo to say, we give them a bed and 3 meals a day, actually, a disgrace.
Yeah, it's not
because
good enough.
It ignores the realities, the harsh realities that people in drug provision have to exist in. I actually had to run away from there. Somebody.
Yes, well, this is the joy of a live podcast. People walking by, we're fine. But do you think that there is more of a willingness now to listen to actual asylum seekers rather than NGOs, support services, or just assuming people know what an asylum seeker actually needs?
Mercy has done quite a lot of work in the last 5 years in campaigning and getting to people. Like, we've been traveling, our activists have been traveling from coast to coast, from county to county, town to town, speaking to Irish people on the issue of drug provision. And every time we meet people who knew there was something called drug provision, but didn't know what life was like in drug provision. And so they're quite shocked when they hear the everyday experiences of people in drug provision centers. So we have built up quite a lot of support base, and the idea now is to get Irish citizens to put pressure on their politicians to actually address the issue.
And your social media has been really good. I think social media is so good for so many things, but, you know, I wouldn't have had that understanding of what food was like in direct provision apart from seeing photos of it from asylum seekers on Twitter. Or, you know, there's a video on your Twitter of the overcrowding, and it seems like you're going around forever looking at the amount of beds in one single
in
room. And like, when is this stopping?
When does it end?
You know, it's like worse than hostel.
It's normal. We had one direct provision center with seven men in one bedroom. And guess what? They call that center an independent living center. Like, what independent living is there if you're sharing your bedroom with six other men?
No.
A tiny bedroom at that. And you have to go and queue for pots and stoves to cook your meal. And you call that independent living. I mean, it's an insult to human intelligence. The idea that you could put 10 men in one bedroom. They used to have 10 men in one bedroom in Mount Trenchard Drug Provision Center, and they closed it. My ex-boyfriend used to live there. The idea that you put in 10 men in one bedroom, and expect them to have any meaning, their lives to have any meaning. I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere. It's not even enough that you put them in 10 people in one bedroom. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's only one bus that goes to town, to city, to Limerick City. It will take them to town on a Monday and on a Thursday, and that was it. Yeah. You only go to the city 2 days in a week. What life are you expected to have in them?
Direct
provision deprives. It deprives people of their dignity. It deprives people of their privacy. It deprives them of any sense of being human. And that is a grave violation of human rights. And there's a lot of denial of that in the Irish political class.
Yeah, absolutely. And what can Irish people do to support? So obviously there's Massey, and people have been great at fundraising at the moment. People can email their TDs. Is there anything else that you would love for people to do?
We've been calling on you to call your TDs now. So
to call your TDs.
Call your TD day.
Corner them.
Ring them up. Call them up. Like, if you get a voicemail, leave a message and tell them to get back to you. They have to get back to you. And you want to discuss direct provision. So we want to annoy the fuck out of them until they solve for my language.
That's how you get action. Yeah, go for it.
To annoy the heck out of them so that they actually pay attention. And we'll be putting quite a lot of pressure now because there's negotiations and government formation that it actually must be part of a program of government to abolish direct provision.
Everyone who's listening, get on that phone straight away. Because the emails are just copy and paste, they're done and dusted, and that's it. Absolutely. I might open up the floor then for any questions from any of the other the attendants. If anyone has a question, if you want to type, let's see. And then while people are typing there, we also have the fundraiser results. So I raffled off some sex toys because I am on brand for Massey. So I have, for anyone who can't see it, I've got one smart massager vibrator from Vibes. I've got some condoms from Hanks, and Shauna from Sex Shop is donating some sex toys as well. So we raised €1,320.47 for Massey. So that's pretty awesome for everyone to have chipped in. So round of applause for all those people.
Yay.
So I'm going to get you to pick a number. We had 56 people donating. I'm going to get you to pick a number anywhere between 1 and 56. And that person's going to be the overall winner of the prize. So anywhere
my favorite number is my date of birth.
Okay.
I was born on the 18th of December. Ooh, so number 18.
We have Rebecca Wade. Hey, awesome. Rebecca, I'll reach out to you. Perfect. And then
congratulations, Rebecca.
One more number.
12th.
Well, okay. Don't be giving away all your personal information here now.
No, I won't give you the year. I never give the year.
Okay. Well, and then one more between 1 and 56, because you're definitely not born in any of those numbers, so we're okay.
My granny was born in 1942.
Ooh,
so number 42.
42. That's Ross Edwards. Perfect. So I'll get all of them over to those lovely people and thank them for donating. So perfect. So do we have any questions from the audience? Oh, thank you, Tony. Oh, we might leave it there. Perfect. Listen, Bilani, where can people find you if they want to chat?
I'm all over Twitter. Where else? I check my Facebook and my Twitter on the regular whenever I'm working. So I'll be checking my Twitter. I tweet quite a lot when I'm working. But other than that, it's hard to get me anywhere else.
Perfect. No worries. And for those people who might be like yourself looking for support, there's Massey there. I think there's a website as well called Queer. Oh, I can never pronounce this.
Queer Diaspora.
Yeah, there you go. This part, wait.
Queer Diaspora.
Diaspora, yes. Thank you. Yeah, I always get that mixed up.
Queer Diaspora Island, yeah.
Perfect. And they have a bunch of resources for LGBT support services as well. So listen, Bilani, I can't thank you enough for coming on today. I really appreciate it. And you've definitely opened my eyes about a lot of the process. So I'll be straight down to Mary Lou's office because she's only down the road. So she can expect a visit. And that might help her get into power. Who knows? We'll see. Perfect. Listen, thanks everyone for tuning in. Again, if you like the podcast, please rate and review on iTunes. It really, really, really does help. If you really want to go the extra mile and support us, you can hop over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You can come find me on Twitter. It's glow_west_. And over on Instagram, it's glowwestinsta. And thank you very much. And we'll see you again next week.